Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to Nothing Concrete, the Barbican podcast. I'm Binesh Maid, and this week we're looking back in the archive, spending some time immersed in 2015's Transcender Festival, reveling in the ecstatic, devotional and psychedelic music of Atom TM and Robin Fox.
It's actually a megalomaniacal feeling sometimes, and you're just pressing some buttons on a controller and the entire room is kind of exploding with sound and light.
Aretha.
We don't do a concert two times the same way. We never perform the tunes twice the same way.
Faze Ali Faze.
Songs, it don't require language actually. It has its own musical language.
And Leo Abrahams and David Coulter.
Although I'm not a music historian, I see that record and the way that that record was talked about and described as being a real milestone in electronic music, certainly, and in the development of what we understand as ambient music now.
The sixth year of the Transcender Festival back in 2015 had pretty much everything, from laser-guided melodies to the never-performed live ambient masterpiece, Discrete Music. All of this reached across East London, including Village Underground and the Union Chapel. Let's begin by exploring Double Vision, a collaboration between deconstructed pop producer Atom TM and multimedia artist Robin Fox, a sensory overload of lasers, video and sounds. I spoke to Atom TM, or Uwe Schmidt, in South America, and on the other side of the world, in Australia, I spoke to Robin Fox. Uwe spoke first.
Let's start at the beginning then. I mean, where did this collaboration begin?
We didn't actually meet. I saw his solo performance, the Green Laser performance, which he showed at the Adelaide Festival 3 years ago. I was really inspired by what he does.
So we met at the Adelaide Festival. I was doing my monochromatic laser show, which is a very literal translation of sound to light, where the relationship is that the signal that you see and the signal that you hear is exactly the same electrical signal. And so it's sort of a noise work that I've been touring for a very long time. Anyway, Uwe saw that show. I think he got a sense that there was something about what was happening that resonated with him. So anyway, that was how it kind of started. And then Uwe planted the seed with Matt from Unsound. Uwe and I both, you know, we chatted over Skype and hatched a plan, I guess. And I was really intrigued by what he wanted to do, which was to take this more scientific model that I was working with and fuse it with the kind of, I don't like calling his sensibility a pop sensibility because it's very different for me what he makes from pop music. But, you know, it's often referred to as deconstructed pop music.
Interestingly, it's always a little bit of a risk collaborating with somebody you don't know. It was very, very easy from the start. I mean, we had to basically plan everything offline, let's say, not in real time, like talking via email, totally unsynchronized. He was in a different mode than I was. He was traveling when I was home and vice versa. He's in Australia. It's a 12-hour time difference. So everything was very mental, I would say. Like, we had to really think about it.
When It's Good is really about that kind of experimental mindset, I think. It's about a real synthesis or a real coming together of ideas and things coming out of those meetings that are greater than, other than what you could have made on your own, I guess. When when we were finally in the room together, we only had a certain amount of time to put together, you know, truly merged sections of work. But then we'd both been working on a lot of material for the project that seemed to kind of sit, you know, quite comfortably on its own. And so we decided that we would highlight the individual within the collaboration as well. So there would be moments where Uwe is performing and moments where I'm performing. It's a truer collaboration in a sense.
We have quite an array of possibilities at hand in terms of different technologies and different atmospheres or energies. Like what he's doing with the laser is very different from what two-dimensional video allows you to do, or the effect it has. We had a lot of freedom, let's say, in different ways of combining things.
To be honest, though, I think it's the merge sections for me that I find most satisfying, because I guess when you collaborate, it's that creation of the new. So when we're actually playing together and sort of bouncing off each other live, that's for me the most satisfying part of the performance.
Were you surprised how the audience reacted when you did perform live?
Actually, yes, and interestingly, we didn't really, or I at least, I don't know about Robin, but when we planned the show, it was very clear for us that we had to perform it from front of house, from the, you know, not from stage, because we are playing actually the video and the laser, so we have to see it, so we have to be on the other side, and the audience obviously is looking towards the stage and the screen, and we are not there.
There are passages there where we play together, which I really get involved with, and I don't want them to end, you know. And sometimes there's a danger in all modes of performance that being in the moment performing it is much more interesting than experiencing it, you know, as from an audience point of view. So you always have to keep that sort of thing in check. And there are some improvised passages from, you know, where I'm just playing the lasers, and the sound and the light are, it's actually a megalomaniacal feeling sometimes to be in a huge room and you're just pressing some buttons on a controller and the entire room is kind of exploding with sound and light. It's a weird feeling. There's a disproportionate sort of godlike feeling in the small gesture that you make and the sort of huge eruption that happens as a result.
I kind of wanted to finish by going back to the beginning again and talking about the collaboration. You obviously didn't know this at the start, but what have you kind of discovered that you and Uwe have in common? I mean, you both have obviously a strong sense of humour.
Yeah, it's true, actually. We do have a very good time on tour, which is very important. But we have a lot in common, and we're both just really interested in the human, you know, the condition of being human and in the way the world works. And we have discussions ranging from, you know, new branches of esoteric mathematics through to all kinds of, you know, philosophies of mind. And
like whenever we talk about music, we have very much the same taste. But like really standing on the different extremes of the same spectrum, maybe, if I can say that. So yeah, I think we have very similar interests and very similar philosophies, maybe even. So, and with a sense of humor, definitely. I mean, it's laser performance, of course, lacks any humor in that sense. It's a very abstract kind of a demonstration of physics, while working with video the way I do, to address different types of information and communication. And humor for me has always been an important element.
Yeah, and then of course we discuss music and art and things that we find inspirational or annoying. But certainly the sense of humor is key. And what I've learned about it, I guess, is what I've learned from the collaboration is that it's something that's okay, great. This is, you know, this is something that people will really love, but at the same time, it's something that unlike anything they've ever seen before. So we managed to create something quite remarkable, and that feels really good. Actually, it's very satisfying.
We're pretty much on the same wavelength with this kind of stuff, and I would say we're very similar in that sense.
Next, we return to the main hall of the Barbican and two of Pakistan's most extraordinary musicians, who provided two entrancing sides of spiritual Sufi music, Faiz Ali Faiz and Zain Sahour. Back at the time of the concert, Songline's Simon Broughton caught up backstage in the Czech Republic with Faiz Ali Faiz. As he only speaks Urdu, you'll also be hearing from his manager, Yasser Norman, translating his words and thoughts into English. Simon began by asking how he was feeling about his then upcoming performance in London.
London actually always have in my viewpoint, because whenever I heard about Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan performed in London, so I always I was so keen and thinking that someday I also have this chance to perform in London, which later somehow I got the chance to perform there. But London for me always is a challenge, because it's not only to sing for the European people, but also for my compatriots who are many there. So I am looking forward to perform this concert in September also.
And does that mean it's a warm response because there are compatriots and Pakistanis in Britain?
Yes, I am very hopeful, because knowing that many Pakistani will be there, because I know that they only appreciated Nusrat Ali Khan there. So I am feeling that they will like my performance also there, and I am very hopeful that they will give me good appreciation.
But you don't have to be Pakistani to enjoy this music, to enjoy Qawwali. I don't understand the language, but I enjoy it very much. So why do I enjoy it as well?
Actually, when I perform, I think that when I will perform, if my compatriots will go for my language, the people like you, they will go for the musical things, my sound patterns, my rhythmic the variation. You will enjoy that, because you will follow the musical language. They will follow the words of the language.
Music.
Actually, for musical numbers or these songs, it don't require language actually. Uh-huh. It has its own musical language, which is universal.
کفتر بودیم هر دو خوش
Our next excursion into a new hybrid musical language is with Amsterdam-based quartet Arifa. Their music goes beyond genre and geographical boundaries, and in the project Voices from the East, they grow in number with guest musicians Zayoksai Meng from China, Nayusha Beramani from Iran, and Vanya Volkova from Bulgaria. Arifa percussionist Sajin During joined me to discuss this melting pot of world sounds which they brought to Islington's Union Chapel back in 2015.
Could we start at the beginning for the group? I mean, how did it all form? How did this come about?
We had a group before called Tarhana, which is a name of a Turkish soup. It was a little bit bigger, and we were trying to reach younger audience. So there was a Bulgarian drum set player, keyboards, electric bass, sas player, Turkish singer. Franz von Chossi was there, and Alex on clarinet was also there. This group toured quite a bit around the world, and a lot in the Middle East and in India, and we somehow never managed to get in the younger people to the concerts. Then they sent us to Iran. They asked three people from Tarhana to go to Iran and to work with Persian musicians for a couple of concerts. So we went, and the group was supposed to play Holland, but in the last minute it got cancelled. And then in that time I was actually also started this quartet, but instead of canceling the concert, I offered Arifa, which never played before. But this concert was in a Beam House, so that's the main concert hall of Holland, the most important jazz world music. And we got the next day a five-star review in one of the best newspapers in Holland. So that was the very beginning of Arifa, how it started.
It means you must have got something right. I mean, there must have been great chemistry between all of the players.
This music was not about trying to rock the place or put the place upside down. It's nothing easy about it, and we don't make compromises, and we don't play existing tunes which people recognize, or we don't play easy grooves. So everything is altmeters, a lot of improvisations. It's concert music to listen to, and somehow There's nothing commercial about it, but it came out much more commercial worldwide than all the other stuff we did before. We don't do a concert two times the same way. We never perform the tunes twice the same way.
You travel a lot. That must have a big impact on you.
Yeah, especially in the beginning. I mean, visiting all these countries, like, let's say, Tunisia, India, Iran, Syria, Lebanon, Turkey. We also played in Cuba. We also went many times to Mexico, Colombia. And always we were asked, like, can you do something with the musicians? Which was always a huge pleasure. And also to work closely and learn from them. And gypsies from Rajasthan. Last once we played with a Syrian oud player, singer. We play with Aynur sometimes, the Kurdish singer. The new CD is, of course, with the three ladies. So that's always very exciting projects and collaborations, meetings. The project is very exciting, and it's actually just the beginning. It's very much developing, and we are getting to learn each other. And after Holland 8 concerts, we did several concerts in France. This will be the third tour in the UK. And the CD will be released. So I'm expecting for the world, it's still a very new project. So it's not available and still a lot of things are going to happen. For the girls, it was very interesting because they come from traditional music. So in the beginning, they did not really get how we work and what is our concept. And we try to understand each person, which we invite in their instrument and their musical culture. But then we kind of try to blend in with what we do. So we are not playing three traditional Bulgarian songs and then three traditional Iranian and then three Chinese. We try to integrate, but in the same time understand. But these ladies, they also play instrument, but they come from China, for example. Can you imagine China, if you're one of the best erhu players, how tough that must be, also the training and how many erhu players there exist? And the Chinese communistic approach. And that also counts for Iran, you know, with their system and being a woman. And, you know, it's like all very tough. And Bulgaria also have this communistic background. So we noticed in the beginning with the ladies who were rehearsing, sometimes like 7-8 hours a day. At the end of the day, we'll say, are you okay? Yeah, yeah. Shall we call it a day? And they would say, okay, you know, no complaints, nothing. Like very used to work. Makes things happen and very different, let's say.
Are you looking forward to coming to London and performing this?
Absolutely. We were there last year on the London Jazz Festival, which was fantastic. A lot of people, we've never played in UK, so that's not so easy. And because of that, we were invited this year by Barbican, which is a big surprise. And so we are quite proud of that.
Lastly, to an artist who never looks back, there are many different Brian Enos, the producer, the musician, the artist, and the architect of sound, light, and chance. To mark the 40th anniversary of his album Discreet Music, musical directors David Coulter and musician and producer Leo Abrahams brought together a team of expert musicians, improvisers, and some vintage electronic equipment to perform a reimagining of this classic ambient album live for the first time. To explain their plans, I caught up with Leo in London and David in the States via Skype. First, to Leo's London studio.
It's an album that wasn't designed to be performed live, so you're already starting an uphill battle.
Yes, I like to look at concerts as going into battle. Lots of people to organise, catering requirements, the threat of obliteration, reputation-wise, if not physical. Lots of similarities there, Ben. Thanks for that. I feel better just talking to you. Yes, it was not intended to be performed, but that's a sort of an inspiring challenge, really, to come up with ways to frame it in a way that honours that original intention. And it is the 40th anniversary sort of celebration of that piece. So rather than a reconstruction, slavish, which Brian wouldn't like, we decided to do something which was something more in line with what he enjoys, which is new things.
You're working on this with David Coulter.
David approached me. It was his idea, and he'd already written a proposal. He's the most positive and persuasive person I think I've ever met. And he announced his idea to me, sort of like those people who announce film trailers. revealing small parts of it as we conceptualized the show together. We had a meeting and developed ideas about how to present it, exactly what you just said, how to get around the fact that it's not a performance piece as such.
This album has been described as maybe one of the first, or the first, of the idea of ambient music. I mean, it's very hard to define what that means.
Yeah, it is. Brian has a term called senius, which is, it relates to the idea that progressions in art or in society are sort of in, they're in the air, so to speak, and there are lots of fortuitous coincidences that happen as ideas crystallize within a society or within an artistic society. He is, I think, rightfully credited as being the inventor of ambient music. He also, part of that is defining what ambient music is. It's initiating a movement. I don't think that works of art are these totems, and so that after one of them's created, we now suddenly have a new language of ambient music. But personally, although I'm not a music historian, I see that record and the way that that record was talked about and described as being a real milestone in electronic music, certainly, and in the development of what we understand as ambient music now.
As a listening experience, it's a little bit like you're hearing some either musicians or instruments, maybe, or even robots in a room who are happily sort of talking and playing to themselves. You're like eavesdropping on a conversation, or that's what it kind of feels like.
Well, I think that's a really interesting point that you make, because when that whole ambient movement was born, was kind of, I think it was pretty much inspired by the Eric Satie concept of musique de meublement, which, you know, which translates as furniture music, which is, you know, it's not ever really supposed to be the main focus. It's kind of just sort of like supposed to exist in a space. And I think that's always been, for me, what is the really interesting challenge about this, which is one of the main reasons why I actually wanted to do it, because, you know, how do you actually stage this kind of music, which is supposed to be kind of incidental to everything else that you're doing? It's not that it's voyeuristic music, but I think it's a different way of listening. And I think that's always been what's really, really, really fascinated me about certain forms of music. You just have to surrender yourself to it and almost like just kind of give yourself over to listening in a different way.
When I was thinking about conceptualizing this show, I realized that a lot of, well, one of the functions of technology is to streamline. And so when you go and see an electronic music show now, the equipment is very streamlined. It's quite easy to carry things around, really. You can carry your show under your arm. Whereas at that time, it was quite cumbersome. And I would like to celebrate the cumbersome nature of that technology, because strangely, it becomes a spectacle in itself. Mm. I think tape machines are beautiful, and I think old synthesizers are beautiful. It's getting rarer that they're seen out and about, both professionally in my job and certainly in public. And strangely, in the face of what we have now technology-wise, there's a touching humanity to those things. Not in a Heath Robinson kind of way, because they remain absolutely beautiful feats of engineering.
I think Leo and I both, you know, having produced records, and, you know, if you look at both mine and Leo's sort of CVs, you know, we've both worked with some pretty amazing people over the years and continue to do so. It keeps it all fresh, and it kind of means that, you know, after 30 something years of earning a basic living, I suppose, you know, from playing music, why we still want to do it and why we still do it. And I think that's why Brian himself, you know, he's constantly pushing the boundaries and constantly just trying to make new stuff. So I think, yeah, I think that spirit of adventure and collaboration will be very present in this discrete music thing. And that is very definitely informed by, you know, the kind of the example of Brian the Great. You know, it's because, you know, let's face it, he has been a very, very important person in the history of British contemporary music, I think it's fair to say. And, you know, I'm very, very flattered and honoured that he's entrusted Leo and I with his original seed. I mean, obviously, you know, we're going to cultivate a completely different plant from it, but, you know, without the seed from the original plant, we wouldn't really be able to do it.
The other thing that comes into play when you're obviously playing using old technology and things like that is chance. It's obviously something that's fundamental to his vision.
There's an interesting juxtaposition of the chance element and the systemic element of the music, because discrete music and the Pachelbel, or Pachelbel variations, I should say, are systems music essentially, albeit systems music guided by one's ear and one's hand as an editor. I get nervous about speaking for him, but all I've observed from the years that I've worked with him is he's a very playful person. He's a very intuitive person. I think he pleases himself, essentially. He makes the art that he wants to experience, whether it's visual art or audio art. Obviously, he has a vocabulary. He has actually quite a wide vocabulary. I mean, some of his recent releases have been more to do with Afrobeat than ambient. There's a really wide variety there. But sure, I mean, I think even given his aversion to being pigeonholed, he has this language, which I think he's still interested in exploring.
But I'm interested to maybe, there's also some other great people involved, like celloist Oliver Coates and the Necks and Michael Nyman's famous saxophonist, John Hall. So what were the sort of decisions about bringing those musicians on board?
Well, the Necks were a part of Pure Seniors, which were the concerts that I was also involved in with Brian at the Sydney Opera House, which were three completely improvised shows within the space of one day. And the Necks, as I'm sure everyone is aware, are absolute masters of long-form improvisation. Brian loves them. They really like Brian, and it just seemed like an obvious thing to involve them. Holding one's nerve in a semi-improvised kind of state is a really serious skill. And that's not to be reductive. It's not just holding one's nerve. It's also building without building too much. And I can't imagine playing improvised pieces of 35 minutes, 45 minutes without involving the Necks, because they're pretty much the only people who know how to do it, I think. Mm. Likewise with Benj, I mean, there isn't anyone like him here. Ollie Coates, we went to school together, actually. I made a record with him a couple of years ago. David knows him as well. We were trying to balance, I think, the soloist with the ensemble, and balance both of those against the technology that's involved.
When you read into some of the stuff that Brian has said about it in the past, one of the things that really interested me was he did start something that was and has become part of the furniture, if you like, if we sort of use that, if we carry that analogy through. One of the reasons that he felt compelled to do it, and one of the things that he had already started doing, he was very, very, he said some really interesting things about a lot of the records that were coming out at that time. So in the early 70s, where a record would be two sort of 20 minute sides of vinyl, pretty much. And, you would have the ballad, you would have maybe, the instrumental, you maybe have, a couple of the singles. But what Brian was arguing was that, you put on a record and you would have sort of 3 minutes to get into a mood, to get into a zone, into a sort of a headspace as you're listening to it, which would be a direct play on your emotions. And then boom, you'd have a 2 second gap between, and then bam, you'd be straight into a completely different mood. So what Brian would do, he said that he would actually go through some of his favorite records and just like make compilations of like all the slow movements of a classical piece or classical records, or he would kind of like create these mixtapes that were all in the same kind of mood.
Will Brian come along? I have to ask that.
I don't know. I really don't. I hope he does. I hope he comes along and just in disguise or something, and sits at the back and then slopes off at the end. That's what I hope. I'd like him to see it, I would.
So, discreet and oblique, the music of Brian Eno transformed and transcended the hall on the 26th of September 2015. David, Leo and all the musicians, for me, brought Eno's studio album to the stage with great style and aplomb. I closed my eyes and I definitely got lost in the music from my seat in the audience. I'm Ben Eshmade. Thanks for listening to this archive edition of Nothing Concrete, the Barbican podcast. Here to inspire more people to discover and love the arts with weekly episodes of archive finds and theme series. Subscribe to Nothing Concrete on Acast, Spotify or wherever you find your podcasts. And if you can, leave us a review to help us get the word out.